Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
If there's one thing that my family and friends know me for, it's being an amazing gift giver. I owe it all to Celebrations Passport from 1-800-Flowers.com, my one-stop shopping site that has amazing gifts for every occasion. With Celebrations Passport, I get free shipping on thousands of amazing gifts. And the more gifts I give, the more perks and rewards I earn. To learn more and take your gift giving to the next level, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you today, Rob?
Today, Russell, I am feeling like the sweetest taboo.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Tell me about it.
Well, Sade is actually one of my heroes. So, I mean, that song in itself is just an iconic moment in my life. And I just think she's got so much elegance and kind
Boys.
Of... She's just... Major. And the guest we're meeting today is not Sade, but it's someone else that is also one of my heroes, because I think everything she stands for is exactly where we need to be at the world right now. And it's definitely bringing about progress and community and making space for queer people of colour, and just kind of the most amazing person who I met in Margate recently. And we went for dinner, and she had just curated a show at Quench Gallery, invited by Lindsay Mendick and Guy J. Oliver.
Yes.
And the thing that struck me the minute I met her was her generosity and the way that she loves art and loves other artists, because she's an amazing painter in her own right, but also has a real great ability with installation as well, like an installation artist, because her current exhibition, which is on at Tuwani, is really thoughtfully installed. It's not your everyday exhibition of paintings. Like, it isn't straightforward, even though they're these beautiful... luscious kind of abstract paintings, but even like the seats, the way it's been installed to sort of slow people down, allow people to sit, allow people to be together, commune together, and take your time. And in an art space, it's genius. And flowers and ceramics, and there's all these wonderful elements. So we are very proud to welcome to Talk Art
Michaela Yearwood-Dan.
Hi, Michaela.
Wow. Hi.
How's
a good one. I'm good, thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us.
We were late today, and we've apologised profusely to you. But on air, we want to say sorry for that. But we found you drinking a margarita when we turned up.
Love that.
Yeah, I was just watching memes and drinking a margarita.
And you were
living.
I was like, having a great time.
And then we turned up, and you're like, oh.
Now I have to do some work.
Yes.
Ruined the flow.
This isn't
and
work.
Also, no.
This is fun.
You were worried you were going to be late because of why?
I was watching Drag Race.
Love.
US Drag Race. It got really good. I was the other day, me and my partner were gonna watch an episode, and I was like, no, we can't, because sometimes it gets really unpredictable and you think you're gonna have a nice time and like watching just watching Drag Race, and then like you're crying and you know, sometimes you just want light, chill entertainment in the evening, and this was definitely one of those episodes where we were both crying. I was
sobbing.
Like, putting my makeup on to come here.
Oh.
And I was like crying, and I was just like, going to be late. And no, I was actually a little bit early.
what was emotional about this singular episode?
Oh, it's just, you know, when they do the thing where they're like, what would you say to your younger self? And it always, you know, like, you know, these like really talented, hardworking queer people having to like talk to their younger self, and sometimes sometimes people say stuff and it's just a bit like, whatever, like, you're not, like, you're choosing not to be vulnerable, like you're being very like surface level. And then other times you're crying because they're really digging deep and accessing stuff that obviously you could only kind of like access if you've been through stuff, or you know, you're giving yourself that permission to actually, you know, be in that space. So yeah, that's what happened.
Does it make you think what you'd say to your younger self?
Yeah, I think I was, I don't know when I stopped being a younger self. I was like one of those like 10-year-olds, 70-year-olds, I think.
Love.
I was a bit like, a bit, you know, I mean, I think as a child, you're always a little bit bratty, but I think I was quite like assure of myself.
You was a theatre kid, weren't you? So I think that's why
how
we get
you
on.
Know? Did I tell someone? Who did I tell? Me? Theatre?
Singing.
What? Theatre, darling. No, yeah, no, I went to drama school for like after school drama club.
Same.
Yeah. In Putney, where I like lived near. And yeah, and then I also played instruments in school and outside of school, and I used to go to Saturday music school for like years.
What instrument?
The flute, singing, and piano.
Do you still keep it up?
No, not really. I mean, I could, like, if you gave me a flute,
and you'd said, do play something
a tune,
with
I'd
it.
Be able to do something with it. I'd be able to make noise out of it. If you gave me a piano, I'd, you know, be able to do some scales and stuff. If you gave me like a month on each of them, I'd probably be able to. Do
well, that's
things
impressive.
Again.
Was there art at the same time then? Because obviously you were going to go into a creative field. You were channeling that. You were chasing that.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I, as a child, I don't think I'd ever would have said, "Oh, I'd go to art school."
Mm.
I think, you know, I tried. I did auditions for things for a bit. Skins was big at the time, and like I tried to audition for that, and I did open calls and got like callbacks and stuff, and it was fun. Didn't get anything, and then was like devastated and was just like, acting's not for me.
Yeah,
I can't do that because clearly the world
rejection is too much.
Yeah. And then music, the same kind of thing, but like, you know, you don't like the routes that you're told to take are like the only routes you know. So yeah. I like applied to.
Possibilities aren't there,
yeah,
you don't know.
Yeah,
yet.
And like I, you know, I wasn't like affluent growing up or anything, so I just, it was like, you know, it was always like open calls and like things you could see. So I remember like I applied to the Brit school and I really thought I was going to get in and I didn't. And I'm so incredibly grateful that I didn't because the rejection was so bad that I was just like, well, I'm never ever singing ever again. I'm never going to do any of this stuff ever again. And then continue to make art and did really well at art in school. So
when did art first come into your life? Were you drawing? Were you painting? Were you, where did you find the joy there?
I mean, literally always, I remember when I did New Contemporaries, my dad had bought this little notebook because he always carries around like a little pocketbook and like a pencil. And it was like filled of like all these really bad drawings that I would do as a kid on like the tube and stuff. Cause like my dad lived in East London, my mum lived in South. So I'd like, we'd get the tube all the way back to here. So I'd like draw on the train and stuff. And
what, people?
Or... Yeah, but like really bad drawings of people. And I used to do a thing where I'd colour them in and I would like, only like everyone I made was always brown, but I'd only ever colour their face and I'd forget their arms and legs.
Oh, wow.
That's done. I was like, wearing really long gloves. so yeah, and I just sort of saw my dad and like a bunch of my friends like crowded around him and I was like, what is happening? And he was showing them these pictures that he'd kept.
Why did he carry a notebook for himself or you?
Thumbs out, like he would like note things down, ideas. He's like quite like a ideas man, and he like now he's like retired as well, so he like started like writing poetry. He was like a trained carpenter and did like, he taught design and technology, then he started teaching primary school. So yeah, like he just like drawing and stuff, and he's actually very skilled. He won't call himself an artist, I'm sure. Even though I have tried and told him that he definitely is, but
oh, he's a craftsman and an
artist. He's a craftsman, sure, and he like carves and like whittles and stuff, and yeah.
So how proud must he be? He's hung on to all those childhood drawings, and now you're having these exhibitions, and you're having lots of success, and you're having institutional interest.
Yeah,
what is that like for him now? I mean, must be incredibly proud.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he is. It's quite funny because my dad can be quite a, I think sometimes he pretends to be like quite sort of like stern faced and pretends that he's like kind of just like nonchalant and chill about it. And he'll be like kind of like nonchalant, chill to me about it. And then I'll hear from other people all these nice things that he said. Aww. And then he'll send me like a really nice text message about it all. And I'm just like, thanks, Dad.
Amazing. So yeah, Rob was talking about in the opening that you curated a show.
Yeah.
At Quench Gallery, which is Lindsay Mendick and Guy Oliver's space in Margate. That wasn't the first time you curated a show, or it was?
Yeah, I think I would say it was. Like, it was the first time that, like, I personally had curated a show. Like, obviously, when you'd be in sort of, like, DIY group shows and stuff, you all have a little hand in curating. Mm-hmm. But you're usually showing your own work. So I also think there's, like, an element of, like, I want this space. I'm going to have this space. And everyone else can do their own thing around me. Like, you know, there's that kind of self-serving element to it. But in this show, it was called Hard as Nails, and it was Madalena Zadra, who's a painter, and she makes like these kind of like sort of mono-printed dyed canvas works that she'll like stitch together, and they're quite like, they've got like a humorous element to them, and they're very like simple in like their execution, but they're like the choice of colour and like form and stuff is really beautiful. And we've actually got a frieze by her in our bedroom at home.
Nice. I love her work. I think it's
amazing. It's really beautiful.
And actually, I discovered it in your show.
Yeah, and then we've got Miranda Forrester as well, who I think is getting more like relatively known and stuff. I met her when I went back to Brighton Uni to give a talk about work, and I like purposely went to check in on all the black people in their final year to make sure they were doing all right, because I found Brighton a bit of a difficult space in terms of that, in terms of like race and sort of navigating that space as an educational institute. And Emily Moore, who's an artist who I recently kind of came across through like other like peer groups and stuff, and she's like multidisciplinary. She makes like sort of textile tapestry works as well as painting and like sewing pieces. So yeah.
So Brighton, you did your BA there?
Yeah.
Not a fan of...
I like Brighton, and I liked so many elements of my course, and I met some of the greatest people on my course. But I think, you know, I graduated in 2016. I started my course in 2013, and in terms of like the outside world and politics and stuff, you know, I came out in like the kind of hell year of the world. Like, you know, when Brexit, Trump, Black Lives Matter. And it was especially like being sort of on the outside of certain conversations, but feeling very present within them. Mm. That space was actually quite difficult to be in. Yeah, I liked it. Some of my tutors were amazing. Shout out Mikey Cuddy. She was great. She was a lovely woman. But like, I did find it difficult, but I just kind of just kept my... I was about to say I kept my head down. That's a big lie. Everyone who had seen me laugh if I said that. I was incredibly vocal about everything. But as in, like, I was just like, I want to get first. I'm like the first person in my family to get to this sort of like point at university. Like, as in my mum, my sisters. So I was like, I need to get first. I want to get first. I'm going to do everything it takes to get first. And then left and was just like...
With a first?
Of course.
What was the work like you were doing, making them? Because it's changed, hasn't it?
Yeah. Well, it started like quite similar to actually like in terms of like abstract botanical referencing, very similar to the work that I make now. But then there was this point where I was trying to engage with and discuss identity and my personal identity, and like I was always trying to make work through abstraction and as an abstract artist, and it wasn't being like understood and received well. And like, it was at a time where talking about race specifically in white spaces was very, very difficult, and especially if you didn't know entirely how to articulate yourself to kind of make it palatable and understandable for other people, it kind of felt like I was talking to a brick wall. So it was just like, okay, the only way I can make people engage and understand this is probably going to be through figurative work, because that's all I was seeing represent, like in terms of artists seeing those conversations represented was always through the figure.
Yes.
So I made figurative work, and it was fine.
And you went,
it was good. No, that's a lie. It's good. It was good.
Like, but you moved away from the abstract.
Yeah, yeah. Like I did. Like, so I, first year was abstract, second year sort of abstract until like maybe like the end of the last semester. Then in my final year, I basically just made figurative work.
Wow.
Came out of my first, didn't really make work for a year or so. About a year. And then I had a residency in China and started exploring abstract work again there with like realism elements and stuff. And then, yeah, and then I got into new contemporaries and had my own studio and then felt like the freedom to sort of go back into abstraction.
So the abstraction you were doing originally was different to the abstraction you were doing when you had the residency, because you were inspired by Japanese and Chinese painting methods and craft.
Yeah,
well, Is it the same conversation, or?
Would you like...
When you started off doing your BA, the abstraction then, and what we're seeing now?
I mean, when I started making the abstraction, it was like kind of... it like was like contextless, and like I was looking at organic forms and through like different variations of like organic forms, so like molecular patterns of like leaves and like
osmosis
and just sort of like trying to make it interesting in some way, but it just looked kind of pretty. And then I suppose, yeah, I don't know. Like, it wasn't... I feel like when I returned back to it in maybe about 2018, I didn't really have any idea of what, like, I wanted to say with it until I had, like, a really kind of, like, a shitty breakup situation. And all of a sudden, I found, like, a voice. And I started using text within the work. And it was all about kind of cathartic process into, like... making these works for me as like an extension of myself, as these like kind of like diary entries, so to speak. I made this like small body of work called Love Letters to Siri, because I was like taking all these little bits from text messages on my phone and in the notes bit of my phone, where you like draft a text message and never send it. And I would like have all these really like sad voice recordings. It's funny thinking back at that sort of space that I was in then, because it's just so, like, it's, I can't even, like, remember it entirely because I'm not there.
But you'd ask Siri for advice. You once asked her, Siri, do you love me?
Yeah. You've done your deep dive. It's good. Yeah. I would, like, at the end of making a painting, I would reflect on the painting and ask Siri a question, and she was always really rude. She's... she would be like, I'd be like, Siri, do you love me? She'd be like, you're looking for love in all the wrong places. And you're like, it was a yes or no question. There's no need.
To break it down.
Obviously, I know that. I'm talking to my phone.
I recently got Alexa, because I've got one of those Sonos speaker things.
Yeah.
And I talk to it, and sometimes I'm like, Alexa, what's the weather like outside? Because I can hear something outside and I'm not sure what's going on. And she's like, it's 6 degrees and it's raining. And I'll be like, good night, Alexa. And she'll go, good night. And I go, thanks, Alexa. And then she'll go something like, I do not understand. It always ends on, I do not understand your question.
They're rude. I'm We had a Hey Google, and we recently got rid of it because Google would always think you're talking to them, and you're like,
I'm not talking to you.
Shut up, Google.
So arrogant.
Shut up, Google. It's not about you. But then now, actually, I've realised it's actually quite upsetting that we don't have it in the kitchen anymore. Because when you're cooking, it's quite nice when your hands are all dirty just to be like, hey, Google, can you play?
So when you were beginning to paint, do you think it was like a... Because it was obviously subconscious, maybe. So you're kind of like making the work, and the ideas, you didn't actually realise what it was yet, but it came to you later. Does that make sense? Like, sort of working through making?
Yeah, yeah. Like, the first... Because it's like... I feel like it's like the first sort of like confident paintings, abstract paintings I made were like on... like three canvases. I was trying to make like a triptych of like some figurative work of some fictitious figurative piece of like me and my ex. And I was like, well, this is crap. And then started just painting over it, like mixed a bunch of colours and then painted over this piece and then started building out work from it. Like, and oh, I'm such a liker. I can just probably hear my dad in the background saying, stop saying like so much. I just started drawing plants and started.
What is it writing about plants?
Plants are just, they're literally life, aren't they? And I think, you know, I grew up in a flat on a council estate, and my mum's from the Caribbean, and my mum has like a very good green finger, so she has loads of houseplants in the house. She'd moved up to Leeds now, and I did this video. It's like a 12-minute video of my mum walking around the downstairs of her house, literally showing me all her plants. Mm. And she has, on that count then, I think it was about 65 houseplants.
Wow.
All thriving.
All thriving. Wow. All thriving. If they're not thriving, they go to, like, you know, the plant hospital, which I think any, like, plant, her houseplant owner has, which is the windowsill by the sink, the kitchen sink.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, I keep an eye on you every day. This is the biggest sun trap of the house. Like, you will live and you will thrive.
Survive.
Yeah. And she used to, like, before it was like trendy on Instagram, she used to do the whole like avocado growing from the seed and stuff.
Yeah.
And so I think, like, you know, growing up in London and having a, you know, fairly urban cosmopolitan type surrounding, there was always plants in the periphery. They were just always there. And it was like they always coexisted. And I kind of feel like a space isn't complete without their existence. And then there's, you know, you can add loads of more like intellectual, I'll say like pseudo-intellectual stuff around them in terms of like the balance between like cohabiting and life and, you know, of like climate crisis and their existence within, you know, my person, my being as a human.
Mm.
But also I just think they're a really nice aesthetic and they're really beautiful to look at. And they, you know, they literally cleanse your space. So,
well, this show that's on now, The Sweetest Taboo, there are plants aplenty in that. And you are a newly a ceramicist, you've described yourself as. Are we still saying newly? Because it's been...
No, actually, really recently I've been quite confident about it. People say, what do you do? I'm like, I'm a painter and a ceramicist.
Good.
Real ceramicists probably think I have no business saying that. Lindsay will be like, what? but yeah, no, I am a painter and a ceramicist, I think.
So there's these plants that are coming, there's these wall ceramics that the plants come out of, and you've made these vessels that you've painted.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's, on the top of a lot of the canvases and some of the framed paperworks, there's air plants.
Yeah.
That I was talking to Arnie, and I was saying to the gallery, like, does that come with the work? And they're like, yeah. And you have to live with this air plant, keep it, well, it'll live on its own because it's an air plant. But
you do need to spritz it, like, occasionally.
Away from the canvas.
Yeah. But... of course. I just think they're a really nice little addition to the work. And, like, this idea of, like, cohabiting with, like, the work cohabiting with the plants and then being so present within the, you know, the physical painted element of the pieces, that I just wanted to add like this little
accessory.
Yeah. And I talk about this a lot in my work. People ask me, like, why do I put like little gems and pearls and like gold leaf and stuff in the work? And I'm just like, gotta put on your earrings before you leave the house. Gotta accessorize. And there is like obviously like more of a intellectual depth around why I do that, and it's referenced art history and it's referenced to the Renaissance periods and stuff. But at the same time, I do quite like this like last minute embellishment of a piece. And I just thought the air plants worked.
They do.
Yeah. And they weren't like intentional. They weren't something that I like thought of in the studio. I went to a nursery to get all the plants for the show and I saw them and instantly knew that I wanted to place them with some of the works.
Mm.
And I did, I bought maybe like six and really wanted to like place them in loads of places. And it was like, no, they only worked with a certain few works. And it just added just a little something.
Mm. It's not very often you see plants in an art exhibition.
No. Yeah, art exhibitions are quite cold.
Or at least in relation to a painting or in the way that you're doing it.
Yeah.
I think sometimes you actually just see a plant, almost like a household pot plant. I remember going to an exhibition at Bortolozzi in Berlin, and I think a lot of the works were kind of conceptual, but it was involving houseplants. And I feel like I saw it in London a bit, maybe in the early 2000s. But like, there's a few artists that seem to work in that sense, but yours is very different because it's like you're saying, it's making the exhibition space warmer, isn't it? And
well, you know, with this body of work, I was thinking a lot about the domestic and, you know, thinking about space and spaces we inhabit and the different types of people who inhabit certain spaces. And I was thinking a lot about queer spaces specifically and how when we, you know, I'm quite a homebody person. So apart from like the, you know, the existential global dread, the pandemic was quite nice. Got to be at home quite a bit, make my ceramics, hang out. It didn't hugely like affect me, especially the first one. It was just really nice to be able to be at
home. You were there with your partner as well?
No, I would be at home on my own for like half, like the most of the week, and then she drove, so, and I lived on my own, so I'd get, she'd come and get, pick me up or stay around or something, and then we would bubble on the weekends. But yeah, I just loved those like 5 days on my own, just making ceramics and hanging out.
So if the pandemic hadn't happened, we might not be seeing your ceramics now.
Oh, definitely not. Probably, like, I would probably say, like, that's, I could bank on that, yeah, because I was doing a short little class and it was...
Online or...?
No, like, in person.
Ah, right.
I did two classes and then we all got sent inside for the pandemic. So I did this class, I learned how to make a pinch pot. And to throw a small straight vessel. And then the pandemic happened. And I was, you know, I literally thought, oh, that was like one of the things that I was enjoying before we had to, you know, stop going out and stuff. So I bought loads of clay.
Mm. And you would do it what? A kitchen table?
I didn't even have a kitchen table. I had like a coffee table and I'd sit on the floor and I would just hand build. And I had to buy a desk, had to buy a chair and stuff because I didn't have any of that in my flat because I was always at the studio. So I quite like my home being a place where I don't really like working at
home.
Separate, yeah. Yeah. The second I get inside my house, I'm just like, I want to sleep. I want to relax. Yeah. I don't like working from home.
And these were air drying clay.
Yeah. Yeah, I just kept on. At first, it was just I wanted to learn how to make ceramics. And so I was kind of trying to carry on what I was being taught on that course, which is like a beginner's guide to clay. And I made a plant pot. It's pretty successful. I was like, I'm going to make a vase. And it was a really small little one. Made like a little candle holder. And then, you know, it didn't look like it was easing up anytime soon. So I was, I'm going to make the biggest vase I could possibly make. I made one was like 90 centimetres.
No way.
Yeah.
Not on the coffee table.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we're just like clay arrive in the post, like slabs of clay.
Yeah. Amazon had like one and it was on a really fairly good deal. So it would be like 10 p.m. at night and I'd run out of a bag and I would just be like, click, click, click. More clay came the next day. We'd just be sort of faffing around in the house until the clay came and I'd be like, cool.
Do you think it was about clay in particular? Do you think there's something like about the touch? Like is it such and, a sort yeah. of, yeah, and connecting to the earth? And
yeah, and I think anyone who, especially like stuff on the wheel, anyone who does work with clay, I think they can attest to how much it centers you and how sort of at one with your practice you feel when you're working with it. Mm. And when I started working with it, there was no intention to sell things that I was making. I just wanted to make things for the house. I made a butter dish, but I made a butter dish out of air dry clay, so it did break within about 3 weeks. but like it, I just really wanted to learn how to make things. And I wanted to learn a new skill that wasn't painting, because I think as far as my arts education went, and then the practice that I was building outside of that went, everything was about painting. I did like a specialised painting course. I was always, you know, painting was always my medium. So I just wanted to try something else.
To give yourself a break from the intensity of the relationship.
Or could you paint during a pandemic as well?
I tried and I really like I said, I really don't like working at home. Because I think why the ceramics worked, because I didn't really consider them work in that same kind of
way. That's great, they come along.
Yeah, but so you have a need to make it,
don't you? It's like you were forced not to be at the studio to make paintings, but you can't stop making or creating.
Oh yeah, I never.
Compulsion.
I always kind of think of myself kind of like a, you know, I'm an artist, I guess, as a job, but I forget that I'm like actually really into it and like a necessity.
Yeah.
So I need to make. Yeah.
So the clay's out of the flat now and into the studio.
Yeah. No, the second I could get out of the studio, my gallerists saw potential in the ceramics, and you know they were placed in shows, online shows, and in person shows.
Wow.
And
still air dry clay, or
well, yeah. At that time, like my friend Hannah Watson, who runs TJ Bolton Gallery, she wanted to put me in a clay show, and I felt like you don't have to do this. But she generally just really liked the ceramics, and I thought felt kind of silly being there, because, you know, there was a great artist, like Katie Stubbs was in there, who's like a really great and amazing ceramicist and now a friend of mine. So I was in this show, and all of a sudden there was like a value attached to the work that I was making. So obviously the next step is to how do we refine this? So I bought a kiln.
Did you?
Wow, really?
A really small little one
for the studio.
Bought a kiln.
How much is a kiln?
It depends on what size you get, Russ.
Small little kiln.
It's just, you know.
Some of them are expensive. Some are like five grand, some are 10 grand. It just depends.
Oh, it was much less than that. It was like 1.5.
Right.
Yeah, it was like a solid investment. And then I thought to myself, well, ceramics better get better.
They're properly part of your practice now then.
Is there
a hierarchy for you with painting and ceramic, or are they all part of the same language now?
They inform each other and they converse with each other. I think the movement that is now present within the paintings wouldn't have been achieved if I didn't have ceramics, and like glazing ceramics is a process which was completely foreign to me. The risks that I'm able to take with painting now all come from the kind of like unpredictability and ceramics are so unpredictable. You can make something, think it's really solid and together, put it in the kiln, it'll break. You can spend hours glazing it, and then it can come out not the shades of the colour that you want, even if you've like really tried and you've done tests and stuff before.
Yeah, it's devastating.
Yeah, so it's made me less precious with the paintings. But then I don't think I was ever that precious with paintings. I just think if they work, they work. If they don't, they don't.
What is that then? An instinct?
Yeah. And I think it's just, it's like one, like we've got one life. Like, I think I have a lot of pride, like admiration for people who really think things through a lot with their work. I'm not that kind of person. I am really like instinctual with what I want to do. And sometimes I'll make, and if I don't think it's working, I just stop and I'll start something else or paint over it.
I was going to say, so do you destroy it if you think it's a mistake or not working?
Yeah, there's no point continuing and like really overworking your mind trying to figure out how something will work, because you can just come back to it a bit later. There's so many pieces of work which I've come back to months and months later, like a year later, and figured out a way to like resolve it. But if I spend loads of time in that moment trying to really fix something which I don't think is going right,
Yeah, it just gets worse.
Just gets worse.
Yeah, and then you regret having painted over the bit you did like.
Yeah. Yeah. I would take things, I'd make whole works and I just wouldn't like them. And I'll take them with a canvas and I'll actually just cut out areas I like and put them onto other canvases.
Oh, really?
What, like collage on tops?
Yeah, I used to work a lot with collage and stuff. So I think in terms of things that inform the paintings, collage has always been one of the things that I've always sort of lent to inform what I'm going to paint, as well as now, like, the movement from ceramic. It's, like, so, like it's full-bodied, you know? Yeah. So, and I just bring that to the paintings.
What are you like with studio visits? You were just saying then your gallerists will come and see the ceramics, and are you quite shy in the studio, or are you...
No, I'm like... I've had to... One of the best things Maria ever said to me was to be more selective. She's like, what do you mean? Like, my studio is my house. It's open to everyone. So I used to let people come visit me in the studio quite often. And I've had to scale that back now because I think there is, I need to be in my own space and be able to work things out without having any kind of opinions from other people. And they're usually positive ones. So, like, I thinking things work, and I think I need to be, have the autonomy over those decisions myself before what I want to show.
Yeah, critical kind of eye of your own.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, because sometimes positive affirmations aren't actually helpful.
Yeah, especially when you don't think something is that way, and then all of a sudden you just think, oh, well, if they think it's good, then it's fine. And there's been times where I've sold work, which I don't really like.
Oh, no.
And it's, you know, at a point where... I would need the money or the money was helpful to extend my practice. But now I won't show things that I don't feel confident in.
I guess that's just in a way, a valid part of being a young artist and growing. And the thing is, these days, there's more interest, I think, in artists at a younger age as well. So, like, there will be a collector who might say it at a time when you do need the money. And even if you're not quite sure, but then maybe you'll see it in 10 years' time and you'll be like, I like that work.
It's all creativity, I think. I mean, as an actor, I know that if someone says to me, the way you say that line's really funny, or I really like the way you deliver that bit, it fucks it.
Yeah.
Because I'm completely conscious of it every time it comes to that line. And even though it's a compliment and the nicest possible thing they could probably do, and they think they're being really generous, it fucks me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And if someone goes, that doesn't work for me, I'm like, okay, that gives me something to work with.
Yeah.
In some ways, you need the kind of negative.
Or constructive criticism.
Yes, exactly.
Like, well, this pointers is it. Yeah. To push you forward. I always think, like, I mean, not from everyone, people I actually respect the opinion of, but constructive criticism works really well for me.
Yeah, same.
Sometimes, especially if I'm not feeling something, the positive affirmations will literally just grind my gears and I'll just get really pissed off. But I'm stubborn, I'm a Taurus. I just think you need the space to be able to work through things. And I think as well, with when it comes to being a young artist, and if you do make work that you don't feel so totally confident with, but someone sees value in it and buys it and stuff, I think that you just kind of have, sometimes you just have to go with that and like know it within yourself. And then just, because you need to develop and you need to grow, and quite often you need the financial backing to do that.
Yeah.
And so, like, you know, because in me now, I'm like, I would never do that. But like a young artist, if someone comes and has a price for you on something that you don't like, take it, because you need to grow. And like,
and also you can then buy the clay.
Yeah.
You can buy the paints.
You can, if you know that you can make, you know, if you can make your work better, and there's like, who am I? Who is anyone to tell someone like to not, you know, sell?
How old are you now? 27.
Yeah, I'm a sweet little baby.
So you are. So you're getting a lot of attention and a lot of eyes on your work, and it's selling. It is selling. Mm. Is there, being 27 and that all happening now, what sort of thought process is going through when it comes to the longevity of your practice and your career? Do you consider those things?
Yeah. Someone asked me the other day if I'd like to be an artist forever. And I'm just like, yeah, obviously.
Weird question. Why do they ask you that?
I don't know why people ask questions they ask.
Yeah.
People ask.
Ask Siri.
They ask some weird questions. And, you know, sometimes it's it actually they're helpful because then you actually access that thought in your mind and you never would have before. And you know, I didn't set out to be an artist. I set out to do an arts degree and work within the arts. I thought I would have some sort of gallery job or teach, and I would still find a lot of enjoyment through teaching. I don't think lecturers and any teaching staff at all throughout the country get paid enough, so it makes it difficult to want to do that. But I find a lot of enjoyment from being able to steer and navigate people into making their best work, making their best choices. It feels good to be able to share my knowledge, and even though it's like not, and like receive knowledge from other people, like I ask and I get support from others as well. But I would always like to be an artist, and as a young person navigating this industry, it's tricky. Because I think about where I'd like my career to go and what I'd like from my career. And there are certain things that at this critical stage I need to do or need to ways
tactical
I need to behave.
Sort of move.
Yeah, and it's annoying sometimes because then you kind of feel that you can't be authentically yourself within the work you make. And, you know, with this most recent show, I think I felt quite nervous because the last show that I showed in 2019 with Tawani was quite different, still abstract but quite different. And at that time I thought that show was super vulnerable, but this one was way more. And there is a sense of, I feel like when you access that kind of area of vulnerability and you make work which is like quite overtly feminine, I'm always worried how critical artistic eyes will engage with that work, because I feel like they kind of see those things as naive in some kind of way.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Arts, the arts podcast, and we're here today with Budweiser beer, and we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also where you won the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself. And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and it's really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser also giving people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and talk art with Sir Peter Blake.
But why
is it overtly feminine?
I mean, I think flowers and I think those kind of colour palettes, like pink is a prominent colour within the work. Mm. And it's romantic in context. And I lean into and enjoy and intentionally make them that way. Because I've had the criticisms I've had on my work before, one of them was like, do you know, your work's quite feminine, isn't it? And I just kind of like sat there and I was like, what was the... I don't understand. That's a statement, not like, are you trying to criticize the work? And it was in a studio visit. And they were just like, yeah, like, you know, are you okay with that? Of course I'm okay with that. Like, that's an intention. I'm a feminine person. And there are like different elements to femininity. And I think as a Black woman as well, there are lots of restrictions around how to present and access said sort of attribute of being feminine. There is this kind of like a masculine energy of strength that's attached to Black women specifically that I probably adhere to in loads of ways, but don't want to be my like big signifier. So for me, there was a lot of strength from accessing the comfortability of feeling vulnerable and feeling feminine and letting others see that and feeling very like at one and true of myself to let others in like a very
compartmental.
Yeah, like sort of like very like rigid art environment to be like, yeah, I'm making work that is gentle in approach in certain ways, but also quite punchy in other ways, but it's wholeheartedly me, and part of me is this like femininity.
And that's actually what's good about the paintings and the new show is that there's this dynamic between it. You've got two elements. One is like a kind of a softness, a gentleness, maybe like an empathy or something, which I think you have heaps of, versus a kind of tougher edged element, because there's like swirling imagery within it. And even the flora and fauna or leaves or, you know, flowers, they do have an edge to them as well. There's a kind of a balance between the
there
two.
Might be a thorn there.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, yeah. And I like that tension. In
it's a, yes, a tenderness and a fuck you.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, it's quite funny because like a majority of the paintings in this show are from quite a sort of gentle space of like feeling in love. And like both with like myself and space I'm in and with my partner and like through like different versions of myself. And then you go around the corner and there's like this last sort of canvas painting, which is kind of probably how I was feeling most of the time in the studio. And it's just like, I fucking hate it here. And it's like, I've been making work during a pandemic. I've been making work with Boris Johnson as our prime minister.
Yeah, joke.
With just accessing global politics on a regular and in like my very like confined solitude of my studio. So sometimes I'll just be really angry and by myself and I have to, you know, either rein that in or put it into the work. But it amuses me that like a lot of the works are, you know, fairly gentle and soft in a way that it's allowing people to just like breathe and take a moment. Within the palette that's used, within the text that's written within the works, you know, with the seats that people can sit in and take some time out. And then there's like, go around the corner, it's like, oh, fuck you.
Yeah. So in a way, there's a way for you to create space for yourself.
Yeah.
To feel joy, to feel love, to feel tenderness. And then you're also trying to share that with others, like within the installation, so that if you come as a visitor, it might be a respite for people or, you know, because I think there's also a lot of joy within your work.
And that's like definitely what I'd want people to take away from it. And it is, you know, I started making the work that I make, and I think a lot of artists do. I think there's some who do and some who make it for others and some who make them for themselves. And it was always like making it for myself. And in turn, like, it's like kind of like group therapy. You know, the lead therapist could ask the group a question.
Mm.
And it takes one person to be to be open and to reveal how they're feeling about that and answer that question, but then everyone else to be like, oh, okay, and then like get the conversation going. And so for me to like, as a young Black woman, to be making abstract art in itself from the ways that I was forced into figurative work feels like protest almost. And then to choose confidently that one of the central themes of my work are going to be love and the other one is going to be self, again, feels quite like vulnerable, but also like a protest. Like I'm not speaking on behalf of a collective group. I'm speaking on behalf of myself.
Mm.
And I invite anyone from any walk of life, of any, you know, socioeconomical background, from any race, from any religion, from any gender, sexual orientation, to find something within that they can relate to. And if that is healing, if that's just enjoyment, if that's like shared angst and anger for the world, then I feel as an artist, I have achieved what I set out to do.
Yes.
You're the first person starting that conversation. You're standing up going, come on in.
Yeah.
Let's go. Let's engage.
Yeah. Who do you love? Oh, my God. Tell me who you fancy. You know?
Gossip. It's basically a gossip.
I do love the earrings. Like the idea of when you go out of an evening and put earrings on, or your nails.
Yeah.
I read about the importance of nails.
Yeah. Well, that sort of leaf, that especially in like earlier bodies of work, less so in this one, was this repetitive form that carried through loads of the works. And it's an idea of a leaf. It's not like a specific, you know, titled botanical, like visual that you know. It's like a suggestion of something you know, and it's the same shape as my favorite nail shape, the stiletto.
Yeah,
it's the same shape as like a drop of water, you know, like a drop of oil, a teardrop. It feels like, in its shape, it has like a lot of life enriched with it, and there's kind of like a feminine attachment to the things that it represents to me. Mm-hmm. So like when I do the little blue sort of sequin items in that shape, you know, they're kind of like gestures of like teardrops, maybe, like a nod back and a reference to you know, Chris Ophelia's No Woman, No Cry.
Mm.
And and I feel like the shape feels very feminine because it's, you know, it has that kind of like bodied, lower half body to it, pear shape.
Talking about Chris Ophelia, that was a big inspiration for you.
Yeah, because, you know, in schools they don't teach you about women or black people. And a teacher asked me if I was going to apply to do an art foundation. And I was just like, why? I can't, like, it's fun and everything, but it's like, I'm not going to get a job as an artist. Like, I don't really think that it's for everyone. It's, you know, it's only like men, white men that can do it. And she went away and came back and showed me all these incredible black artists.
Oh, wow.
Chrissa Philly being one of them. Yeah. And I was really touched by that work because I, you know, I grew up in London, but I wasn't a person who was going to galleries and museums and stuff. I don't think I went to a commercial gallery until I graduated from university.
That's a good teacher.
Yeah. Yeah. I think she's
just the one you gave a shout out to.
No, that was Mikey. Mikey, oh. who taught me at Brighton. She was just a very gentle and nurturing tutor. Yeah, the other teacher, I don't know, there's something like, I feel like I could reach out to her at some point, but I don't really want to go back to my school to give a talk, so I know that that's how it would end.
Right. they do get very demanding. Yeah. I've had a lot of reach outs recently since talking.
Yeah.
Which other artists were you presented with back then? Like, as signifiers that you could, because if you think about the Black British Art Movement and like Labena Hameed and even artists that, Charmaine Watkiss, or Barbara Walker, or there's a whole generation of artists.
I think, like, I'll say that it was Chrissa Philly, Carrie Mae Weems, Cara Walker were the ones I can remember. It was like mostly Black American, I think Mikalayne Thomas.
Yeah.
That I was presented with.
Mm-mm-mm.
And yeah, I don't know. Like he stood out to me, and I guess it's, you know, medium of paint, being
location.
British. Yeah, exactly. And
Doreen Lawrence. Yeah.
Yeah, like that. And yeah, exactly. Like I knew of the story in which he was referencing. That was, you know, household story growing up.
Stephen
Black
Lawrence.
House, yeah.
And Damanola Black, Taylor. Yeah.
But in Black households, and especially growing up in South West London, it was like, that was something that I was familiar with and knew all about. But yeah, I've never been very good at like artist research and spending a lot of time looking at other artists' work and like taking stuff from it. And I think there's something about, like, I never wanted to feel like I was stealing. I wanted to sort of know what someone did and like take a few things occasionally, but and be inspired by them. But quite often, especially as an abstract painter, I didn't have a lot of people that I looked to artistically. I don't even know how I got my language.
What are the, talking about your language, what are the rules that you have set for yourself? Is there things that you're like, I am not touching that, I will not go near that colour?
Purple, man. I know, like, I've used the colour purple, but, like, I don't really like it as a colour. I've made a painting in it entirely, and I really liked that work. And the reason I made that painting was because I was staying away from the colour specifically.
So you were challenging yourself.
Yeah, yeah. And I did that with the colour red as well. I made like a whole body of red work because I used to hate working with red, mostly because it's like very messy in the studio and I don't, and it gets on everything and stains everything. And like I felt it was very loud as well. And like, you know, when trying to find your voice and your language, the last thing, and you're not totally confident that the last thing you want to be is too loud. But rules. Never a white canvas. Never. I'll never start working on a white canvas.
It comes to you white though, doesn't it? Or
I know, I stretch them and make them, and like I prime them in animal hide, like rabbit skin glue.
Tracy Emin does that.
Yeah. Good old Trace. And so they're still canvas colour, and I will then usually just mix up a colour or a couple of colours and then ground the background in something like any color. Often it's pink, sometimes yellow, often black. Never a white canvas.
So you kind of create your own base and space in a sense, don't you? Even though it's limited to the size of the canvas, it's still you've started it.
Yeah, and it will be like an empty canvas to me still, but it's had, you know, a touch of me already on it. So, yeah.
What was it like when you first, sorry, What was it like when you first brought in text into the paintings? Was that like a eureka moment, or was it
depressing?
Well, the context of what I was writing was quite depressing, and it was quite funny because the paintings were all quite pastel and like lofty in energy, and people would say like, they make me feel so happy, and I'm like, you're not getting it because I'm sad. and then I started thinking about the, you know, the added contextual understanding of colour and the sort of semiotics around what certain colours mean. So I started making replica paintings with black backgrounds and then doing like the same thing on a more pastel background and then on the black background, like mimicking the movement and then putting them in shows and like seeing how they would respond.
Oh, wow.
What were
surprising responses?
I mean, I think people were actually engaging more with the text and when they were on a darker background. And I think, you know, it's partly because it was easier to see.
Mm.
And I think there is this thing of, especially with abstract art, not spending time with it. I think in big sort of figurative scenes, there is so much to see that you will spend time with the work and you will, you know, look at all the characters and what's going on in the piece and try to start building up a narrative.
Mm.
But with abstract art, it's quite often like you see the colours, you see how it makes you feel and you move on. And by putting this text in there, it gives these suggested themes of what I'm talking about and what I was feeling when making the work, but it also forces people to just be with the work and spend time because people are nosy as well, so they want to read all the bits of writing.
But you see text, you read it. I mean, that's a human condition.
So yeah.
As soon as you do that, it does automatically slow you down.
Yeah.
I guess the titles, because you actually have titles, you know, fully formed sentences as titles. So is titling important too?
Look, titling is important. Do I remember many of the titles of my works? No, like at the time when I...
the time it meant everything. And then when it goes, it's gone. Yeah.
I've always got like, one of the women at my gallery was like, can we have we'll send the images over. It's like, can you fill out this form with the titles? I'm like, you usually have to ask me like 3 times to send it. But they mean something in the time and like they are thought of... But it's kind of like asking someone to name a page of their diary.
Yeah, no, I understand.
That's interesting.
Yeah, like, you know, it's like, and then sometimes I'll read everything that I've written and like maybe pick out a line and expand on that. Or I listen to a lot of music and a lot of music plays into
while you're working.
The work. Yeah, yeah. And then like the lyrics will appear in works and stuff and people coming up to me at the show and being like, so I just want to make sure that was a Ja Rule lyric written on the bench. I'm like, mm-hmm. Like, okay, I just wanted to make sure. It's like, okay, goodbye. Like, so they'll like play into like the titling as well.
And there's a dance hall star called Spice.
Yeah, she was in she's been in a few, her words have been in a few works. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Do you listen to music while you're making the works?
Yeah.
And also, do you think that music informs the kind of compositions? Because to me, there, when you look at them installed together, there is a musicality, almost like a music script, you know what I mean? When you write out notes or something, there's something about that in it. And even the title of the show being a reference, I'm assuming, to Sade, but I wasn't sure if it was.
Yeah, I
assumed it was.
Yeah. I do think that the sort of the freedom and of musicality... and what I like listen to when I'm working, and I'll listen to the same kind of playlist until I exhaust myself, and or like the same albums until again I exhaust myself. And they do play into how I feel when I'm making, and then the movement will go internal. I feel like sometimes you can tell when I've listened to a podcast versus when I've listened to music. So like with the big triptych was definitely. I think I was definitely finished in like a podcast setting because it's more like refined and like together. And then some of the other ones are a bit messy. And there'll be like moments where like I would be listening. I think one of the pieces very faintly at the bottom is some Missy lyrics.
Mm.
And that was just because I was listening to it and I was just like, it's a vibe. And put that in. But then the piece builds out and it becomes like this sort of this moment that I know I had in the space and I'm sharing people in an exhibition space, but everything else that's built up on top of it is more considered. But yeah, so they do feed in any other title of the shows.
Do you start from the middle out? Because a lot of people will now recognise your paintings, that there is this kind of void that appears in the middle, and I see it as like an emotional cloud or something, a vessel, and the work seems to kind of, like a galaxy, like a Milky Way, it explodes from the middle. Most of the paintings feel like that's where the core of the energy is.
It's for you.
Yeah.
The space in the middle is for you to be in. It's like to frame you. It's like for you to be immersed in the work. So there's often this like a negative space that you can be framed in, and whilst enjoying the work, like in the show as well, everything's hung a little bit lower. So a person can be like more present with the work. So yeah, the space is just, it's like for possibility, I guess.
Contemplation, that
yeah,
area.
It's just, yeah, I like it.
No, I mean, it is, you recognise your work because of that negative space in the middle.
Cool. Are you saying I've got a signature style? Is that what you're saying?
The next show, you might have moved taken somewhere new. Yeah. You should, you know, keep doing your thing.
Keep on your toes.
Listening to yourself, as you were saying, like when you were growing up, you didn't necessarily go to galleries or feel that was even a route in life that was open to you.
Yeah.
How important is it for you? I mean, I guess, do you feel, not a pressure, but is it a privilege or something to sort of feel like you might be changing things and like opening up the door for people to come in, and even the way you consider installing your shows? And I know you think a lot about queer people and queer people of colour and the trauma that both those sort of marginalised groups of people experience. Because I sometimes feel like being queer, being a person of colour, you have trauma that means that you won't necessarily even find success as early as other people because you're dealing with your shit. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I know people that have survived like sexual abuse or all kinds of domestic abuse, traumas, things like that. And then it means that it took them 10 years longer to even work out what they wanted to do in life. You know, it's just a slower journey.
Yeah, I mean, for me, like, so I would go to museums growing up. My dad used to love to take me to museums, and like the South Ken little bubble was there all the time. Not the natural history. I was more of a science museum and V&A girl.
I can see that, though, in where your mind works. Because you like a challenge, don't you?
And
you
love
like
the science.
Well, the science, that's the plants, that's
loved
the botanicals.
It. Like, we'd get there and I'd be like, what time are the shows at the launch pad? Like, I'd love it. And then the V&A, up and down those, like, the jewel sections and stuff.
Yeah.
Just looking at all the fashion. When it comes to, you know, I don't really see, like, I have had trauma in my life. I hate to kind of like talk about it in that way because I know that there's like a scale sometimes of how much other people have been through. But as like I think there was lots of time where I just didn't feel welcome and able to access certain spaces. And I think, you know, growing up where I grew up, I was able to sort of have like a dip in toe. Like, my dad's a teacher, so obviously he was interested in seeing all of these things. But I knew loads of people who weren't, and like I'd have friends who were really into theatre and the arts and that, and also friends who completely didn't know what was going on. And like, I kind of always, when I be making work, I want people to feel like they can access it. And as someone who makes abstract work, I know that that in itself makes it harder for people who especially don't have like a artistically educated mind. And there's this hierarchy within the art world that makes spaces make spaces just completely inaccessible for certain people. So like, even where my show is, in Cork Street, I would never have, like, I remember going to Savile Row to go to Abercrombie and Fitch once as a kid and being like, I should not be here. It's not allowed. I felt so uncomfortable in that space. And even bringing my work into that space now, it feels there's still like a bit of discomfort within me, just like to be like, why do I belong around here?
Imposter
syndrome. Yeah, I shouldn't be around here. Yeah. And I want to, like, it's a bit like that, those installations of, you know, 70s Caribbean households. And there was one at, what's the Life Between Islands?
Tate, Britain.
And it's like things like that where it's like a space where you go in and I want you to be like, feel a bit at home.
Mm.
And that's why, like, the space I was making, thinking about people who, you know, go into a gallery and think they need to like be out and in really quickly because they shouldn't spend time there because you're not meant to spend time there. Mm. You can't afford anything in the space, so you don't want to spend time there.
Apologize for being
yeah,
there.
And like the benches, they people weren't sure that they could sit on them, and they were made so you can sit on them and spend time being in the space. And you know, those houseplants which you see are really common at home, and like flowers, it just feels a bit like a home. And I really wanted that to, you know, be something which would help people feel more comfortable in the space, and like allow themselves to be in a space even if they did feel uncomfortable. I don't even know if I answered the question.
You did.
Okay, good.
Beautiful. So your upcoming for you is an inaugural show, an incredible space called Queer Circle, of which I'm a trustee, which is a queer art space institution that's opening up, and you are creating the inaugural show.
Yeah.
What is the pressure of that? What are you working on? And how do you feel about this space being in London?
Well, I love that it's in London, obviously. I'm an unapologetic Londoner. it's quite embarrassing how much I love London. It's such an important space to have. I met Ashley by chance quite recently in life, like maybe last year.
This is Ashley Joyner.
Yeah. And I met through my friend Jake, and another friend, Kate Dunn's show at TJ Bolting. We like crossed paths as we were leaving. So, and we were introduced to each other, and he asked if he'd come for a studio visit, and we got talking, and then invited me to do the show. And I felt at first quite a lot of pressure, because I think in terms of like my own queerness, I'm not like the, you know, quote unquote, like queerest person. And like, it's not the big integral thing within my practice as an artist. And it's not the biggest and largest conversation I want to be having, but all the conversations kind of work in tandem with each other. And, they all kind of exist at the same time. So I felt quite honoured that he invited me to be the artist to open the show.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause especially of all the other amazing queer practitioners that I know. And the show's going to be... The show's going to be good. I'm making some more ceramics. I don't want to say what they'll be yet, because I've not made any... Yeah, I've not made the thing that I would like to be the prominent thing within the space, and there's a chance it might not work because ceramics are fickle and they've got a mind of their own. But there is going to be a really large mural.
Is it a big space you're working in?
Yeah, it's the main gallery space. It's a fairly large space. It's going to be a really large mural on a wall that kind of curves, sort of being... like emulating the paintings and that kind of open abyss that the paintings have, also sort of engulfing you. And
but they're like, they're frescoes, aren't they? Like big skies and unearthly visions.
Yeah. Yeah. I just had a residency not too long ago in Brescia at Palazzo Monti.
Mm.
And there's lots of frescoes there.
That's in Italy.
Yeah. It's in Italy. lots of frescoes.
They love a fresco in Italy.
They love them.
now they love them in queer space.
Yeah, they're gonna get a big one.
You're painting it directly on the wall?
Well, no. We're building a sort of a curved wall.
Amazing.
Yeah, painting it directly onto that.
I can't wait.
So there won't be any actual canvases in that show. It would just be a big mural, and I like the kind of ephemerality of it, that, you know, it'll be a 3-month show, and when it's done, the mural's done. So if you see,
we'll get destroyed.
Yeah.
And that feels good?
Yeah.
Cathartic?
I feel like it's like, it's, you know, it's, things get to be moments in time, right? And if you get to see it and spend time with it, you get to see it and spend time with it. And but I don't think that there's a necessity. I think there's, as like a painter working with like commercial galleries, it's like everything has this like value and it's always set on like purchasing and, you know, like owning art. And I like that the space gets to own it temporarily for a bit and then it's just no one owns it and it doesn't have to exist anymore. And maybe it might be like fragments of it might be able to be kept permanent in the space, but I just quite like the idea that it exists for the time it exists for.
Temporary.
Yeah.
And a memory then.
Yeah.
In people's minds.
Almost like a play, you know, like if you get to see it, you get to see it. And if you don't,
it's word of mouth.
Yeah.
Theatre kids forever. Yeah. Let's high five that.
There'll be pictures.
That's cute.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
There'll be imagery, card. Of course.
The imagery will be there. Yeah.
Get it on a tote, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Details. Tote.
We love a tote. We love a tote.
Love an accessory, don't we?
We ask every guest two questions. The first is, if you could do an imaginary art heist and take home any artwork, what would you steal?
Oh, yeah, I had to think about this one. art is big, man. It's hard to steal things. So I instinctively, the first piece of artwork that comes to mind is Matisse's La Danse at MoMA.
The whole room.
The big La Danse, you know.
La Danse, right.
Yeah, yeah. I would, if I could steal the whole room, imagine.
Russell's good at this.
Sorry, I was thinking Monet for some reason. The room that goes around Matisse, right?
Yeah, and then I always forget the title of the exact one. Actually, no, I haven't. And the Noah Davis's 40 Acres and the Unicorn.
Oh, yeah.
I love that piece of art. Yeah, I think it's beautiful.
Nice. Where have you seen that?
I saw it recently at his show at David Turner. But during my degree, I was looking at his work in 2014, 2015, primarily because I was having to source all the, you know, interesting black artists. And I was always more interested in looking at like who was making art right now. And then when he passed away, I was devastated and kind of had to sit alone with this devastation because I had no one else seemed to know who he was. That was really sad.
Yeah, he went way, way, way.
It's 2 years ago.
Yeah, it's tragic. Yeah. It's such a loss because his painting is extraordinary.
Well, and what he did for the art world as well.
Yeah, yeah. For other people, exactly.
Yeah. So I am. When I went to that show, I found it very emotional and I'm quite hard to affect as a person, I was in tears. And especially that was one of the reasons why I wanted to make benches as well, because I had that film at the back. And I was sitting in this chair, kind of like immobilized, just crying. And I remember there was two girls just sitting there chit-chatting through this film, and I shushed them. And I was like, can you just shut up? I'm trying to have a moment. Can you shut up? And I really just felt like this was just the whole show moved me so much that I would steal that and keep it really precious.
With no one chit-chatting around.
Yeah, with no one. No one's allowed to look at it. It's just in a room by itself, just me, me and the unicorn. The dance will be in the kitchen though. Everyone can see it. In my imaginary massive house that I don't have. Yeah.
Soon. What does your partner think of your work?
She seems to like it. She likes to think everything's about her.
Of course.
Yeah.
And what all the works are
all about. Is this one about me? Oh, I'll talk about a piece of like, the one about me.
Do you have your own work at home?
She's got a print of one of my works.
A print? You won't give her an original.
An AP.
Oh, okay, an AP.
Yeah.
That is proof.
Of a print.
Is this the Whitechapel one?
Yeah. We've got that at home.
Are you going to try and hold on to any of your work? I do have bits
of pieces and stuff, and I will hold on to things, and I do hold on to things. She seems to like the work, but having it at home, I think, is a lot. And I'm starting to try and collect art more now from, you know, my peers and start buying some things. Yeah.
Who are you trading with?
Who do I trade with most recently? Most recently, I traded with Miranda. I say I traded. Miranda's given me a work, and Miranda Forrester, she's given me a work, and I still need to give her something. Me and Joy will do a trade at some point.
Lavinjo.
Yeah. And otherwise, I would just get out my card. Just pay for it.
Start buying. Yeah.
I want to start building a collection.
Great. That's exciting.
Yeah. It'll be small. It'll be from people who I believe in and that are coming up. Especially at this point in my career, like, I'm not going to spend all my hard-earned money on lots of really, really expensive pieces, but I do really want to start collecting.
Amazing.
Yeah.
What is your favourite colour, Michaela?
Green.
Green?
Yeah.
Okay, because of the leaves. Botanical.
Yeah, I just think it's lively and I look really good in it, so...
Enough said.
You have a green fur coat.
Yeah,
we're loving it. Fake fur.
Yes.
Yeah. No, I look good in green. Brown and green go really good, really well together. If you didn't know that, trees. green. I think, and I think as a color to use when you're painting, it just has so much depth, and I think it's like an underdog color. I think.
Underdog colour.
Yeah, I don't think people like would choose it as often, because I think it's kind of like, it feels like a useful colour. Like, it's like a colour that you need to use. So if you're depicting life and still life and landscape, it's a colour that you have to use to be able to depict what you're depicting. And it sort of serves a purpose more than, you know, like, I think pink and things like that. There's like, you know, with flesh and stuff, but sometimes the way it's used, like a very hot, deep pink, it's like an addition, and like red, like you don't see those kind of tones in real life. So I think green's a little bit of an underdog colour.
It's also known as a colour that sometimes gallerists don't like when people make green paintings, because it's not popular with collectors. And Catherine Bernhardt did a show in New York called Green that was obviously referencing money in New York and, you know, American life and stuff, which her work is obviously consumed with. But it was also this idea that it's a colour you shouldn't make paintings of, because if you make a green painting, it will never sell. There's a kind of myth of, like, popular colours. Yeah.
That just, like, really, like... Something inside me was just like, I'm going to make so many green paintings.
Yeah.
Doesn't sell, I'm going to make them all. green.
You heard it here first.
I probably won't. I'll be a bit too intense.
What's the best advice you've ever received with regard to your art?
Like I said earlier, Maria told me to be selective. That was quite good. Another friend of mine, Rosa, Joanne Ado. Oh my God, I always get your name mixed up. Sorry, Rosa. She on a talk once said that, and I always think about this every time I write an email, like, delete your sorries. And, like, especially, like, I feel like you apologise a lot when you're asking for things. And if you're doing, like, a collaboration and you say, like, sorry, I was just wondering if there's a fee attached to this, you'll just, you know, cut that out and just say, what's the fee? And I always think, and I always relay that back to younger artists who ask advice, or like, can you read through this email? And it's always going through and, like, stop apologizing and sort of feel secure and affirmed within the space that you're taking up and the job that you're about to do.
That's great advice.
Really good advice. That's useful advice as well.
Yeah.
For everybody, really.
Practical, but it's also self-esteem. It's about, like, owning your own space. And your own talent.
Taking up that space and
what
not apologising for yourself.
Deserve.
Yeah.
And should be rewarded.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that. What a great way to
it was. Yeah, it was. Yeah, Rosa, she said it and it was really...
Thanks for that, Rosa. Are you on Instagram?
Yes, I am on Instagram.
Do you love it?
Do you live for Instagram?
I spend too much. I've got a daily cap of how much time I'm allowed to spend on it.
I think we all need to do that. I mean, it's an option.
What's
your Instagram handle?
Artist and Gal.
Perfect. So at Artist and Gal.
When did you get that handle?
It's at university. I used to have two Instagrams, and then it was a choice of keeping Michaela Yeo with Dan or and keeping like as like my personal one, and Artist and Gal as my art one. And it was like, which should I keep? I should really have like a professional presence. And obviously I got rid of Michaela Yewedan and kept Artist and Gal.
No.
And it's Michaela Yewedan gone to someone else, another Michaela Yewedan.
I deleted
now.
It. I don't know. Someone's probably got
And there's
it.
Definitely no apologies there.
No, Artist and Gal.
And yeah. You can go to Tuani Contemporary Gallery. They're based in London, but also now Lagos. They have a new gallery there. But their current exhibition is on right now, isn't it, Russ?
It is, exactly.
With Michaela.
Yes, it exists. And then we've got...
what date?
It was on till the...
22nd of April.
Yes.
It's on until the 22nd of April.
Yeah.
And yeah, please go and see this show if you get a chance to. And then if not, you'll be able to go to Queer Space.
Which Queer Circle.
Queer Circle, sorry.
Yes.
You'll be able to go to Queer Circle, which is an inaugural show. Will be Michaela Yewedan.
That's right. And it's going to be called Let Me Hold You.
Yeah.
Beautiful title.
It's a great title.
Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll be back very soon.
Bye, Michaela.
Bye.
Bye, everyone. You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram @TalkArt, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.